All right, part 11 today of our series, and we're coming towards a conclusion. I promise we're going to get there really, really soon. So just the last few things here as we kind of wrap up our study in this. We are at part 11 of, let me see if I can do this right. Here we go. Of how creation and how human nature inform our understanding of morality and ethics. And our current focus really is, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? How does this relate to the covenant of works? And what do these things together reveal about different questions of morality and how we are to conduct ourselves in this world? So that's our focus in these last few weeks as we kind of conclude this study. And last week we saw, I made the argument, as we think about what is the image of God, I argue that it's not just characteristics and properties that we have. Like, we have the ability to love, in distinction from the animals. We have ability to think and to rationalize and make decisions. Kind of characteristics and properties that we have. Yes, that's part of the image of God, but it's not just to be kind of refined to just that. Neither is it just our ontological makeup, ontology, being, what we're made of. Well, we're rational creatures. We are relational creatures. That's kind of who we are. We have souls. I guess kind of these two go together in some respect. But the image of God isn't to be kind of narrowed down to just that either. And I argue that it can't be separated from the task that God has given us in creation. But as we think about the image of God, it's more holistic. It includes all of the above. We've got to look at the kind of totality of these things when we seek to identify what the image of God is. So, last week, I said we're going to look at three aspects of the image of God. Royal sonship, which we looked at last week. Royal rule, and eschatological end. I think that when we get kind of look at these things together, this notion of what it means to be made in the image of God kind of emerges out of that. So, last week, in regards to royal sonship, I argued that we have an analogical, that's analogy, right? An analogy, and a theological representation of God. That's who we are. I gave the example of something like, okay, the eyes of the Lord go to and fro over the earth, and He observes all the actions of men. Well, we have eyes as well. We're able to see outside of us. And this is an analogy of God's seeing. And who we are physically and who we are, again, to use a big word, ontologically, in our being. And this represents God in an analogous way. And that's what it means to be a royal sonship. Adam had a son. He beget a son, begot a son, in his own image and likeness. Genesis 5:1. There's an analogy there between a father and a son and God and his son, Adam. Also, the image of God relates in regards to royal sonship, we talked about last week, that there's an indispensable relational aspect to this. And we talked about how, okay, the image of God is something that man and woman possess equally. Man and woman were created for one another, and we talked about, well, what does this represent? Our relation to God, or perhaps the triune relationship to one another. Regardless, there's an indispensable relational aspect. We were created for community. Community. Royal sonship, in this respect, plays into and connects with this idea of royal rule, which is what we're turning to now. So, any questions on what we talked about last week? Pretty simple. Oscar?
I can't remember. Did we decide if there was like a physical aspect of being created in the image of
Yes and no. And I'm going to get there when we talk about Christ. But God does not have a body. He is spirit. And so it would be wrong, very, very wrong, to say, oh, we're made in the image of God. That means God must have a body. And yes, certain theological, probably heresies, what we would call them, argue that God does have a body based upon that. Mormonism believes that God has a body. That's why I stressed analogical analogy. There's an analogy. That's not the same as equivocal, right? It's not equal, but it's similar. Now, I always use the example of something like, you know, she was as mad as a tiger. You know, there's an analogy there that's not the same thing as saying she is an actual cat-like being. So in that respect, there's an analogy, but not an equal representation. Not to say that they're equivocal. Good question, though. And again, we'll talk about, well, what does this mean for Christ? Okay. All right, today I want to talk about a royal rule. And what I want to argue is that what a thing is cannot be separated from what a thing does in creation. There is an intentionality and a purpose in creation, in all of creation. And when we read the account of creation and we read the account of the creation of man, it's no different. What a thing is and what a thing does cannot be separated. Here we'll look at a few passages, beginning first with Genesis 1:6. What do we read there? And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. What am I trying to argue here? What a thing is can't be separated from what a thing does. This expanse was created to separate. There's a purpose behind it. To separate the waters from the waters. Genesis 1, 14 through 16. God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And let them be, so there's a creation of these lights. That's what a thing is. What does a thing do? Let them be for signs and for seasons, for days and years. Let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. In creation, God creates the things that God creates. He does so for a reason. And to properly understand that thing that He created, you have to look not only at what it is, it's a light, but what it does, what it was created for. For seasons and for days and for years. In fact, and this kind of goes back to a broader, maybe a broader way of looking at it in regards to kings and kingdoms. How you doing, Cody? You hanging with me? All right, Cody knows exactly what I'm going. This is Meredith Klein 101, if you guys are interested or curious. There's an order to creation around kings and kingdoms. Excuse me. Light was created, the luminaries, to rule. There's a kingdom and a king that rules that kingdom. The lights rule the kingdom. There's the sky and the seas, which is the kingdom. And the animals were created as rulers of those kingdoms. The birds of the air in the sky. The fish of the sea to rule the seas. And then you have land as well, and their rulers, which are animals and ultimately humanity, Adam. And then finally, you get this Sabbath realm at the end of the creation account, where the Creator ruler is enthroned in his eternal Sabbath rest. God being Lord of heaven and earth, of it all. So the creation account follows this king and kingdom idea. In fact, to break it down in a chart for you. On day one, God created light. On day four, he created the luminaries to rule. On day two, God created the sky and the seas. And day five, he created the sea creatures and the winged creatures. On day three, he created dry land and vegetation. And on day six, he created the land animals and man. See, there's an order here. Now, I will say this is developed more fully in what's called the framework theory of creation. That's not what I'm espousing here. Per se, framework argues that, well, because of this order, and how we can connect those dots, day one to day four, day two to day five, day three to day six, and the correlation between creating a kingdom and then creating a ruler for that kingdom, the framework theory argues that this shows that the 6 days of creation are not literal 24-hour days. That's not what I'm arguing. That's not where I'm going. I think that you can see the framework theory, and that doesn't necessarily mean that God, that creation wasn't in six 24-hour days. It doesn't demand that. We can still say there's an order to this. We can still say that there's a pattern, that God is intentionally communicating something, even in how he does what on what day, without saying that this means that the days don't mean anything. So don't misunderstand me here. But you see the point that I'm trying to make. King and kingdoms go together in all of creation. And the bigger point in that being that there are what a thing is and what a thing is does cannot be separated. To properly understand what a thing is, you have to look at what it does. So let's look at this in regards to man. Genesis 1:26. Any questions or comments at this point? I don't know if the same word, if it's the word, same word, I don't have it in front of me. But yeah, I would say, yeah, the idea is the same. We're talking about analogies even still. A light, the sun doesn't rule the day, by giving orders and sitting on a throne and holding a scepter, but there's an analogous relationship there. That it governs the kingdom in some respect, that it has dominion over the kingdom in some respect, which the sun does. And I think there is something a certain correlation to the word rule and what it means, but I don't have it in front of me. I'll have to get back with you on that. Yeah. In Genesis 1:26, we then read that God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." So there's a creation of the thing, man. There's the image of God being kind of bestowed upon man. But then there's this word "and." There's a continuation here. Can't separate the creation of man as the image of God from the purpose for which man was created. Let them have dominion. That's the purpose. dominion over the fish, the birds, the livestock, over all the earth. This is royal rule. This is where man being made in the image of God cannot be separated from what he was created for, to rule. In this respect, man was created for dominion. Just like the other kings and rulers were created and set within their respective spheres to rule, man was set on the earth to rule as well. That's the kingdom upon which he rules. You follow me in all this, right? All right, let's continue on. As we keep reading there in Genesis 1:26, and we come to 1:28, and God blessed them. And God said, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, on every living thing that moves on the earth. I want to focus in on these two words. Subduing the earth and having dominion over the earth. And what that means. What it means in regards to royal rule. Subdue is the Hebrew word kadash. And if we look at it, it literally means to bring into bondage and to dominate. You'll love the picture that I came up with here. There you go. That's the best kind of analogy of what it means to subdue. Right? There's some sort of threat. And say what? The Trinitarian, yes, exactly. There's three men. Yeah, that's pretty bad. I was waiting for a Presbyterian joke in there somewhere, but you know, just the nature of our group. Say what?
Probably raising his hands
in worship. Okay, wow, wow. Josh is a little cynical about CRBC. there's some sort of threat. There's some sort of enemy, we'll say, for the purposes of this illustration, who has been brought into bondage, right? His legs and his hands are tied down. He's been dominated by these three individuals. That's what it means to subdue. And if we look at this verse in Scripture, if we look at this word in Scripture, we see, like, for example, in many places, like Numbers 32:22 and Joshua 18:1, that it refers to Israel's call to subdue the promised land, to conquer it and to take possession of it. And if you've been here very long, you know that I frequently say that Israel's commission is a parallel of Adam's commission, right? Israel and Adam are mirror images of each other, and we as sinful humanity are mirror images of that as well. With Israel, with the Exodus, the new creation through water into this promised land flowing with milk and honey, with all the promises of blessing and all the threats of cursing, Israel is replaying the Garden of Eden and everything that happened. Even down to the fact that enemies were in the land, like the serpent in the garden, that Israel was called to dominate and to judge and to cast out. So, in this respect, the subdue refers to how Israel was called to subdue the promised land and take possession of it. In 2 Samuel 8:11, David dedicates to the Lord silver and gold from all the nations that he subdued. In the last one. So Man is called, if you remember back, in creation, part of the image of God is the call to subdue the earth, to conquer it, to bring it under dominion. With the obvious, example of that being first and foremost would be to subdue the serpent and to extend the garden to cover the entire globe. Then we have this idea of dominion, radash. This is a classic picture of David exercising his dominion over Goliath. But this means refers to a rule imposed by a conquering enemy. So not only do you subdue everything, but now you rule over it. Leviticus 26:17, it refers to ruling over the enemies in Israel. 1 Kings 4:14, Solomon had dominion over all the kings in the east and the west, and there was peace all around. So he ruled. He sat on his throne. He was in charge. He didn't just subdue, but he exercised continuing, ongoing dominion over the land. And of course, Psalm 110, verse 2, describes the rule of the messianic king. His enemies are his footstool. He rules in the midst of his enemies, even. This is what it means to take dominion. This is the commission that Adam was given. Well, I'm connecting, again, the image of God to the task that Adam was called and created to perform. So to kind of summarize what it means to subdue and rule, in creation, God reveals himself as a ruler and a judge. He takes dominion and subdues the earth, in creating it, by ordering it, by separating things like light from darkness and water from land. God is setting the pattern for Adam. That's why we have the creation account. That's why we have more than just verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's it. No, we have 6 days that follow because God is setting himself up as the worker, as the ruler, as the judge, who is setting a pattern for man to follow, even the pattern of resting on the Sabbath day. Which is why the Lord's Day, the fourth commandment, the Sabbath, is not just something that appears in the Mosaic Law. It's woven into creation itself. We image our Creator even in our rest. I talked about last week how Courtney, my wife, is reading a book, how the lady argues, like, in your home, moms, you know, when you clean, when you organize, when you take dominion over your home, you're imaging God in some respect. Careful not to take that too far, but you get the point. And then God not only rules it, but he judges it. He pronounces it good and very good. This is God exercising judgment as a pattern for man. That's why he says it's good. It's not just, of course, it does teach us that creation is good in and of itself. But ultimately, he's setting that pattern so that man is to see we are to pronounce good. We are to make judgments on things. He is a king and he is a judge. So, in the same way, man was called to rule the earth like God, and to judge the earth like God. He is to represent God on earth as a vice regent. That means he rules in God for God. He is God's ambassador to rule for God, but he's also to rule and judge like God. So there is the position, or maybe we would say his being, his ontological makeup. And from that, he is to then do these things like God. Make sense? That's how we can't separate just characteristics from how we exercise those characteristics. They both go together. And the Sabbath rest even was set before him as the goal to which he was called to obtain. Like God. So in this respect, think about the fall. Think about the fact that the giving of names. God names everything, but notice how he stops. He names everything, but then when it comes to the animal, he stops and he assigns it to Adam. He gives Adam the right to name the animals. Adam being, of course, king of creation, being lord of earth, a higher position than the animals that rule the earth. This is Adam's first step of taking dominion, naming the animals. And this is what part of what makes the fall so shocking, because Adam ruled over the animals. And then here comes this serpent who conquers him. There's a radical perversion, a subversion here of God creating Adam to conquer the serpent, and yet the serpent conquers him. And that's why I would argue one reason why Satan takes the form of a serpent. There's symbolism here that the animal is conquering Adam. It's a severe messed up from how things were created. It wasn't just an accident. It wasn't just something that, you know, Adam was just beguiled. He utterly failed. Entirely. He was called to judge the serpent, to take dominion over the serpent, to cleanse God's temple of this evil intrusion. And instead, Adam and Eve, they enter into conversation with the serpent. And they listen to the serpent. And ultimately, they are conquered by the serpent. Which again, hey, we could tie a lot of things together here. Jesus going off into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights to be tempted by Satan. It's a replay of what's going on here. The serpent comes to him and reasons with him and tries to convince him. And of Christ, of course, conquers, resists, and obeys. Think about this too in the relation of the tree, knowledge of good and evil. Any questions or comments? I've been talking for a while. Yes, there's good bad Adam and bad Adam in that tree. You can see there. You guys are all with me, right? You're not just asleep? The tree, even the name of the tree, it's symbolic for pointing to how Adam was called to make just judgments. Knowledge of good and evil. What is knowledge of good and evil? Judging with wisdom. 2 Samuel 14:17. My Lord the King is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. Characteristic of a wise king was to be able to discern good and evil. In fact, 1 Kings 3:9, Solomon prays, give your servant therefore an understanding mind. Remember when he prays to the Lord for wisdom? God says, you can have anything that you want. Just ask me. And he says, I want wisdom. I want an understanding mind to govern your people that I may discern between good and evil. Knowledge of good and evil, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, is the place of testing where Adam's judgment would be tested, where his knowledge of good and evil would be put to the test. where what he was created for and the characteristics that he was given in creation would be put to the test. And he was to exercise those characteristics rightly. And so, well, Adam was called to judge rightly, imaging his God. The tree was a place of testing. I'm repeating myself. He was going, ultimately, to learn good or evil eventually. The question always was, how? How? Again, we can learn about this by looking at Satan's temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. Turn these stones into bread. Sounds innocent enough, right? He'd been 40 days without food and water. Where was his God? Was God leading him? The Spirit led him into the wilderness. Was he going to be led out there to starve, to die? Lord, where are you? Don't you see that I need provision? Haven't you promised to provide for my needs? Satan's like, don't you see your Father's forgotten you? You better take matters in your own hands. Are you going to rely upon your wisdom or upon God's wisdom? The question was why? Was he going to, Adam, trust and obey? Or was he going to learn the difference between good and evil, or learn good and evil by self-serving and personal experience? And that's why God says when he does fall, he has become like us, knowing good from evil. God says that. He has become like us now, knowing good and evil. In the sense of, he now, best way to explain this. He's learned good and evil. But he's learned by personal experience, rather than by trust and obedience and relying upon the wisdom of God. So the tree symbolizes Adam's call to rule and judge rightly. It was that place of testing where what he was created for and what he was given in creation is put to the test. And he failed. No. Yeah, no, he did not know evil. Adam in many respects was a child. And he eventually he would have he would have eventually seen and learned good and evil. But the question was he going to learn that by committing evil himself or by relying upon God and obeying, trusting?
Why didn't he know evil just as the opposite of what God had committed?
Say that again?
Why didn't he know evil just as the
opposite? Yeah, and I think in some respect, that's where, in some respect, yes, Cody, how far should I go here?
Well, I mean, in some respect, given the fact that he's made the image of God, there has the law, the moral law written on his heart. He had, an innate knowledge, but when he's confronted with evil from the serpent, he's supposed to know. It's a confrontation with evil, and he's supposed to go, this is not in line with the character of God that's created me.
Yeah.
The actual probationary event of the serpent, what knowledge he had regarding evil. It could be that he had the knowledge, but a lack of discern, maybe, between good and evil, until he was confronted with evil itself. But I don't know.
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer, and I think as well, I mean, I know that Meredith Klein and some people get all upset if you say this, but he also argues that there was animal death before the fall, perhaps outside of the garden. And yes, you know, that we know that sin brought death, but he argues that that's in reference only to humanity, that animals died. And animals died before the fall. Part of his argument is to it served as a word picture for Adam so that he knew what would happen. He knew what God meant by death. Just like, for example, we might say that the trees die before the fall, because if you eat the tree, it's dead. It dies. There's decay in creation. And Adam, by illustration, saw what death was. That's how he knew what it was. And so there's a sense of an awareness of evil. But we're talking here about, evil, knowing evil because of his disobedience and experience of evil. And that's where we're making that distinction. It's a very hard question to answer, though.
Would he have known evil by... I mean, Satan, was he even aware there was a Satan or a fallen angel? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we can answer that. So, but regardless, ultimately, as soon as the Word of God is questioned, that right there was should have been like alarm bells that he was to exercise dominion over this creature. All right, so to conclude this, this whole argument is that part of the image of God cannot be separated from the task that he was created to perform. And that this task is inherently ethical. The image of God, then, is inherently ethical. And all of his faculties and properties, all of his ontological makeup, are really secondary in regards to the image of God. They're secondary to the task that is assigned to him. To put it another way, his faculties and properties were given so that he could carry out his mission. You see that? Man is a thinking man. Why were we created as a thinking creature? Is that part of the image of God? Yes. Is that the sole image of God? No. He was created thinking so that he would exercise that thinking to fulfill his task and mission. And that's how we can't separate what a thing is from what a thing does. From how we are created, from what we were called to carry out. And the implications of this, again, to come back, Scripture never points to one thing and says, there, right there, is the image of God. It's more holistic than that. Man's purpose, and the way in which he was to fulfill it, which was in righteousness and holiness, are essential to understanding the image of God. And this has huge implications. It's more than just physical. It's more than just spiritual. And I use a small s there. The fact that we have a soul. The fact that we have personal autonomy in some respect. The fact that we are thinking and rationalizing creatures. It's both together. With a greater end being the task we were created for. And that has huge ramifications, both morally when we talk about how we are to now live, but also salvifically when we talk about, well, why did Christ come and live and die and raise for us? What does this mean regarding our salvation and the place of works versus the place of grace? Or the place of the old man, fallen in Adam, with the new man, recreated after the image of God in Christ. These are the implications I'm going to draw out ultimately, probably next week or the week after when we conclude this series. But it all goes in together. And so, from this respect, as we look ahead, Next week we're going to focus on this eschatological end. We have this aspect of sonship. We have this aspect of rule, how he was to rule then. What was the goal? Because the goal and the reality has huge ramifications for understanding the image of God as well. Particularly because Christ is the one who has obeyed where Adam failed. He is the one who has brought that eschatological goal. And he is the one where, as we look at Christ, we see the full and complete image of God and can understand what it means, what it is, and what it means for our life. So that's where we will go in the weeks ahead. That's all I got. Any questions or comments before we close?